Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Pop Culture Ninja. I'm Nathan, joined here with Nathan. Nathan, how you doing today?
I'm excited to be back and ready to go into our next podcast. It's been a little bit of time. We've about a week since we last recorded, so good to have you back from vacation.
Yeah, it's good to be back. It was a great vacation. Went up to New England. You know, we're all about pop culture here, and so, you know, if I got a couple minutes, just tell some people, you know, if you get a chance to go up to New England, it's really great, beautiful area. Did the Mount Washington tour on Lake Winnipesaukee. It's just a boat that takes you around the lake. If you do the earlier tour, if you go up to the Weirs and you do the earlier tour in the morning, you can go to Wolfboro, New Hampshire. And it's just a nice, small, little town there. New Hampshire is known for its pewter designs and pewter making. So you can go into one of the stores where they, you know, it's made, you know, closer in the north, but it's shipped down to this store. And this is kind of one of their flagship stores that they sell it in. Just beautiful art and designs, you know, great, nice old-time village. So, you know, if you get a chance, you know, definitely recommend taking some time, getting up there and just, you know, enjoying the beautiful sights. Want to make a couple announcements real quick before we get started with today's episode, and super excited about the episode because this is the first time, Nathan, that you and I get to review a DC movie and not completely trash it.
Not completely.
Not completely. It has its issues, as all movies do, but, we'll get there. So first announcement, Honey Go Wine and Spirits has their Beer Fest. Don't forget about that. We're going to be pushing that and making that announcement. The way you get entered to winning the ticket is by anytime we throw out something on Facebook or Twitter, reposting it on your Facebook account or retweeting it on your Twitter account. Both of those will allow you the option to be entered into the drawing. We'll go through, we'll look at the list of people who have done something, we will pick out a name, and we will make that announcement. Also, if you are a crossover listener, so you listen to us on These Go to 11 with Greg Dutcher and myself, you do the same thing. We're posting things on our Facebook and Twitter page on that end. You will be able to be entered into the drawing on that end as well.
And Nathan, regarding the Honey Go Wine Spirits beer fest thing, can you describe it a little bit? I haven't actually been. I know last year was their first time for doing it. Is that right?
No. They've done it. This is their sixth or seventh year now.
Okay, so they've done it. Yeah. Done it all. I think last year was the first year I became aware of it.
Yeah. So they do it every year. The past 2 years, we've actually gotten many more vendors than we typically have in the past. Usually in the past, we try to keep it around 20. Last year and this year, there were more around 30. And so usually each vendor brings 2 to 3 different things you can sample. So you pay one price. I believe it's $35. You get a 6-ounce glass, which for those of you out there who are into beer, you know that if you go to a lot of beer fests, you're typically getting a 4-ounce glass. So you get a bigger glass. And from 12 p.m. to 4 p.m., you just go around and you drink as many beers as you want.
And where is the festival itself actually located?
Yeah, so the festival is actually located across the parking lot from the store on Honey Go Boulevard. So if you go to Honey Go Boulevard and you go into that Y shopping center, you'll see the store on the corner, and then right across the street from the store next to the Y's, there's a parking lot. It's pretty big parking lot. And so they close that off. They, you know, take over the whole thing. They have some squatty potties out there, you know, that you can use. There's a live band going on. There's a food truck. The great thing, though, is also there are several restaurants within the area. Mm-hmm. So you can feel free to drink a little bit and even go into the restaurants. You know, if the food truck and food vendor isn't your thing, I'll tell you, the food vendor they're going to have is fantastic. I think it's called Gypsy Food Truck. They've been on Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives before. Cool. As, you know, a really great place to eat. But if that's not your thing, you have Lib's Grill, which is a high-end steak and seafood place that you can go to. You have Liberatore's Italian Restaurant
at the very end,
in the shopping center. You have R&R Taqueria, which is a great Mexican place.
Yeah, that was also a Food Network reviewed show.
Yep.
Reviewed restaurant. They also have chopsticks there for Chinese.
Yes.
They've got a Subway.
Yeah.
And they have Bombay Nights, which is Indian food. So you pretty much have about everything covered in that shopping center. And all those restaurants are fantastic.
Yeah. And, you know, if you're sitting there and you're just kind of wandering around, you can bring your drink. I know that Bombay Nights, chopsticks, and R&R Taqueria are all BYOB.
Yep.
So, you can feel free to bring your little, fill up your, 6 ounce glass, go in, grab some food, drink, and then, just leave, get some more, go back in and drink.
Yeah. Taqueria in particular is much more of a sort of, it's not as much a sit down place.
Yeah, exactly.
You can go in and be really easy to go in there, even bring tacos.
The food, yeah. Outside. Yep. So, it's a great time. Make sure that you go ahead and, retweet, go ahead and repost on Facebook that so that you can be entered to win. Like I said, you'll be able to win one free ticket for each podcast that you are doing this for. So there is the possibility that one person could win two tickets, or there's a possibility that two people could win one ticket. So make sure you do that. Second announcement that we want to make is our book reading. Nathan, I'm going to go ahead and just turn that over to you real quick since you are spearheading that.
No problem. So took a little bit to really get going, but I now have on Goodreads a place where we can discuss the book. The book, again, is Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. I've just started reading it. It's really good so far. It's very kind of quirky and has elements of J.K. Rowling, has elements of Roald Dahl, has a few elements of Stephen King, too. So it's a pretty neat mix of things so far. I'm curious to how it's going to translate into a movie later in September. But what I'd really like to do is start getting the ball rolling on discussions for that. So as of this podcast, you can go to the Facebook page and we'll have a specific post there that discusses particular places in Goodreads where you can talk about it, places on the Facebook where you can talk about it. And I think what we can probably do too, because I think it's going to soon be a case where Nathan and I have more access to recording easier,
yes,
that we can put up a few mini recordings as we talk about the book,
yep,
just little areas where you can kind of listen and participate with the Goodreads, but we'll have small mini episodes, if you will, where we'll discuss what's going on with the book. So I know there's a couple of people who have the book who are reading it, looking to expand that group. You can still get the book and pick up at any time. Mm-hmm. We're probably going to run this until sometime September, probably early September, and then we'll have a final kind of podcast covering it. But in between, we'll probably have just little updates on the book, what we think about it and how it's going. And if you want to be a part of that discussion, send us email, post on the Facebook or the Goodreads, and we will include that, this part of the discussion, in our recordings when we record.
Yep. Sounds good. So Nathan, we're going to go ahead and we're going to jump into our reviews right now, because we're just going to transition right into a book review. So you picked up a copy of Harry Potter and the Cursed Child.
Yeah, I did get a chance to read Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, which is being billed as the 8th Harry Potter story. In reality, it is not a novel written by J.K. Rowling. Rather, it is the transcript, really, of a play that's playing in, I think, London's West End right now. And it's based off of a Rowling story, but it hasn't been written by her in the style that you're familiar to from the novels. It's not a novel. It is essentially like the script.
Yeah.
And it, meaning it has all of the stage directions, it has all of that, and a dilution, in a sense, of character details, story details that you would expect when you're reading a book.
Right.
Just a lot of that stuff is not there, because it is intended to be more of the skeleton and the structure, which all the production artists, all of the actors, everyone involved in the stage production brings their talent and vision too, laying it on top of the story. So what you're reading is really the script with that bare bones bit. None of the stuff that an author usually brings to help a person imagine the world that's there. This is leaving a lot of big gaps in there. So you're having, in very specific way, it is just the story in terms of what is happening. You have the dialogue, you have that, you can envision it in your head, but it's a lot of it left open. It's very spare in a sense. It isn't detailed or furnished in the way. It's a difference between having a room where you can see the architecture, you understand the way it's supposed to house something, but it's very sparse. The interior decorators haven't come in and spruce things up. The guy hasn't done his feng shui yet. There's still a lot of that stuff that you're used to having in a book isn't there.
Sure.
So that being said, it's a very different experience. It's a lot quicker to read.
Yep.
It's a lot quicker, I think, to sort of digest. It isn't going to be a satisfying experience, I think, for most people that are looking to delve right back in this Harry Potter world and have that same experience. It just isn't.
Yeah.
Everything I'm hearing about the stage production is that it's kind of beautiful and gorgeous and visually intriguing because of the way that they bring magic to life on the stage. Everything I hear about it is that the production itself is what makes this special.
Yeah.
So if you're reading this and you're failing to see what's special about it, it's because what is special seemingly isn't there.
Right.
So you're going to have a little bit more work. That being said, anyone who is really into Harry Potter, like a big major fan, is probably going to want to read the book. I will say that the story itself isn't necessarily essential. It certainly doesn't bring this world to life in a way that grows or expands much of what we've seen.
Right.
So the story takes place 19 years after the events that happened in Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows.
Okay.
And so we've gone past Voldemort being defeated, and I won't have any spoilers for the Cursed Child in here, but of course I'm going to probably spoil a minor thing here or there about the original Harry Potter series.
Right.
Just in the course of talking about it. I'm not going to say too much other than to say that 19 years later, and if you remember the final scene of the book, the last Harry Potter book, it ended with Harry and Hermione, not Hermione, Harry and Ginny and Hermione and Ron.
Yep.
They're there. Harry's married to Ginny and Hermione and Ron are married.
Yep.
And they are there with their kids, Draco Malfoy and his wife, or Draco's there with his kid and he's sending them off.
Yep.
And in the context of The Cursed Child, this begins with Albus Severus Potter, who is Harry's son, going to Hogwarts, having his own experiences, and bonding with Draco Malfoy's son. That's the basic gist of things.
Sure.
The story progresses from there. There's some kind of give and take between Harry and his son. Harry's a side character. You've heard me complain on this show before about issues with the way parents are treated in these stories.
Right.
I have a little bit of an issue with the way Harry seems to respond to his son. Seeing the way the life that Harry came up through originally, it's not that Harry is seen as this bad guy, but he becomes essentially, seems like all heroes become clueless fathers eventually.
Gotcha.
It just seems like a very easy thing to divert to. I'm not really sure that those passages, at least the way it's presented in this script, without a lot of the character motivation, work for me.
Yeah.
So I didn't really get that relationship between Albus and Harry very much in the story.
Sure.
The Albus and Draco's son, their interaction is interesting, but what essentially happens, I'm going to just leave it at this. This becomes a kind of time travel story, which I'm starting to feel is a new lazy way of making something feel the same, give viewers, readers, whatever it is, the same experience without really creating anything new and trying so hard to recapture that magic. We'll just go back to the old.
Right.
So we're going to go back to the events you're already aware of, and we're going to play with time, and it's a way to bring characters back who were gone. It's a way to change characters you thought you knew, and yet at the end we can just sort of bring it all back, and if we choose to, things can be as they were.
Right.
Now, it's not entirely. There are some heartfelt moments there. There's some stuff that's interesting. But this isn't an expansion of the world as much as it's just a revisitation.
Sure.
I would be very curious to see it on the stage.
Yep.
I'd love to see it on the stage. It's piqued my interest to see it that way. But in a lot of ways, that makes me feel that this book, this quote-unquote book, is really just an advertisement for the production.
Right.
Because you're not going to get a full experience. And as a story, this, I believe, I don't have all those extra details to know. As a story, this wouldn't quite be up to snuff with what, if she had done something like this in the original series, I think people would have had an issue with it.
Sure.
So to me, it's not so much that it's bad, it isn't, but it is, I've noticed that the trend with Rowling seems to be, how do I keep this Harry Potter gravy train running? And this is just the latest train car in that Harry Potter gravy train.
Yeah.
You can pass it if you want, and I don't think you're going to miss out on a whole lot.
Yeah. No, and that makes sense. I've heard that Rowling is trying to work to bring the play to America. Right now it is only in London at this point. And she is trying to work to bring it over here. My brother read it. He said he enjoyed it for what it was, but it wasn't a whole lot. So
that's a fair assessment.
Yeah. All right. So Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. Now we're moving on to the bulk of the podcast, Nathan. And this one, like I said earlier, I'm super excited for. You and I went Thursday, saw the Suicide Squad. Go ahead. Initial thoughts.
So first off, we didn't get an opportunity to see it at the pre-screening. Now, what that meant is by the time we saw it on Thursday night, reviews had already rolled in. Usually I'm seeing something before reviews. I try not to read reviews before I see the movies.
Sure.
Because you want to be able to form your own opinion and not be walking in thinking about, oh, well, I'm going to pay attention to this because it's supposed to be good, or I'm not.
Yes.
Or I'm paying attention to this because it's supposed to be bad. My son he went to the library and read to the librarian, so he won tickets to the Orioles game. So that's where we were. On Tuesday night, we couldn't make the screening. But so you and I went Thursday night. So close to the first showings you could have. I really enjoy that with some of these bigger movies now, they're doing screenings at like 8 o'clock.
Yes.
Instead of like midnight. Because the midnight one is rough. So I think there were even earlier screenings, but we went to the 8 o'clock, the standard, meaning there was no IMAX. There was no – and it was still a pricey ticket.
Yeah.
But there was none of the stuff that you – the bells and whistles that we've talked about. So we can't really comment on the bells and whistles. You say Greg saw it.
Greg saw it. Yeah, he did not. Nope. He typically doesn't, for the same reason you don't like to. He wears glasses. And so wearing the 3D glasses over the glasses.
Cumbersome and distracting most of the time. So going into it, now I hadn't read a lot. A couple people I know who write reviews, who I keep up with just as kind of a friend to like read their work. I had read their reviews, but I hadn't really gone out and read. I did notice that the tomato meter was very, very low at that point. I don't know what it is now. At the time of Thursday night, it was like 29% fresh.
Yeah.
Which again, we've talked about it before. Rotten Tomatoes is an aggregate, which means that percentage is the percentage of reviews that are saying the movie is legitimately good.
Right.
That 29% is people giving it the fresh tomato, which in a 4-star rating is usually 3 stars, maybe 2.5. Mm-hmm. It's like I've seen C+ reviews of my own be considered fresh. It's usually like B- and up. So you think about that the other percentage is not a 29% doesn't mean that this movie is so much worse than every other movie.
Right.
It just means that a lesser degree of critics liked it, that were willing to say this is a good movie.
Yeah.
So when you look at that, I think anyone going to see Suicide Squad will probably agree that it is not, if you're just rating it on your own personal meter, it's not a 29% movie or 30% movie.
Sure.
And in fact, as I've now seen the movie and read the other reviews, most of the other reviews are not really slamming it. They're people that are teetering on, nah, I like some of it, but it's kind of a mess.
Sure.
That's kind of where I'm coming from.
Yep.
I will say that I was almost pleasantly surprised because of the negative reviews that I had gone into the movie prepared for. I know this is my own personal opinion, a Batman versus Superman kind of scenario, a movie that just didn't engage me at all. I sat there waiting for it to be over. Or even worst case scenario, a Fantastic Four, one of the few movies I ever actually got up and just walked out of, the movie that came out last summer where I saw this movie was going absolutely nowhere, that there was no better use of my time to remain in the theater. And having caught up with the rest of it, I thought there was about an hour left. Turned out there was 20 minutes left.
Right.
It actually became the Fantastic Four. That there really wasn't anything to that movie. So I was prepared for that.
Right.
Going into it, I had a better time, I think, because of that. Because I was ready to see something that was very sloppy, that was very thrown together. And there have been a lot of issues with editing. We know that we had heard that a couple times. They had gone back and done reshoots for this movie. So I expected this thing to be a bit of a mess. The director, David Ayer, this guy who's done movies like End of Watch and Fury, he's usually more on the grittier, seedier side of things. The concept of this movie is maybe supposed to be a little grittier. Mm-hmm. The irony, of course, is that it's not as gritty or as dark or as gloomy a movie is Batman versus Superman.
I know.
That's a very strange thing to say, but it isn't. And I honestly was probably expecting something more along the lines of League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, which is probably people are thinking, oh no. But with League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, it was a movie that I watched and I saw promise in the bits
Yes.
As it had been constructed. And I thought, somewhere along this production, these people thought they were making a good movie.
Yeah.
And yet, when it came to the screen, it was a complete and total mess.
Yeah.
I think Suicide Squad is a hot mess, but it's a hot mess that mostly works in the way they were trying to get it to work.
Yeah, that's what I agree.
I went into the movie, and of course, I think right off the bat, you get the idea that seems like DC is trying to make this their Guardians of the Galaxy. This was their intention, I think, to take a group of comic book characters that people probably don't know much about, that your not rabid fan knows much about,
right,
and turn in something that felt a little fresh because we weren't familiar with it. Guardians of the Galaxy kind of did that for Marvel. No one could figure out a reason why anybody wanted to see a movie about a talking tree and a raccoon with a gun and these other characters that nobody cared about. So when they pop up and they, you know, you see the movie, you get into them as individuals and as a team. They're trying to do that with Suicide Squad. I don't think they were nearly as successful with it because this movie does have a lot of issues. It plays to me almost like a movie from the 90s.
Yeah.
Like, again, these are titles that are probably going to freak some people out when I start mentioning them because they're like, well, I don't want to compare to that. But movies like Tank Girl.
Sure.
Movies
sure.
that like were trying for a very specific kind of tone.
Yep.
It, for some people, probably kind of worked because it reminded you of what it was like to read a comic, but weren't entirely successful because they were almost too quirky. They were too goofy, and the people making them didn't quite know what to do with them.
Yeah.
Suicide Squad feels like a movie that is at odds between its director and its studio, who wants it to be a certain thing, and meanwhile the director is trying to bring his own vision about.
Right.
And I don't think the Suicide Squad we see in the theaters right now is that same movie.
Yeah.
But there's enough of that movie in there that I thought it was fun.
Yeah.
I don't think it had nearly as big a budget. There's special effects in here that harken back to like Spawn or The Mummy Returns, where I'm looking at this and I'm like, wow, this is some clunky visual effects. But what the visual effects are portraying is kind of cool. It's kind of interesting. They try to kind of go for broke. They go out there with, don't want to spoil too much here, but the Enchantress, who's a member of the team, sort of becomes the villain.
Yeah.
So we can set it up in a minute, but I'll just say, before we go into any kind of spoilers, my basic feeling of the movie is I enjoyed it. It's a fun little romp, but you will notice, if you're paying attention, you will see the places that this movie's kind of been hacked together, places where it's been overly edited, places where they haven't entrusted what the director was trying to do, so they've added a lot of what I consider like digital doodling on top. A lot of, like, literally, in some cases, digital doodling with weird little things popping up on the screen and the stats of the characters. None of that feels organically part of the story. It just feels like something the studio kind of slapped on top to add an extra layer of gloss. Mm. Like a kind of Adobe After Effects sort of thing. Sure. So I liked it. There are specific things I like about it that I think elevated it. Will Smith actually being one of those things.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think he gave a performance that was out of his norm, but what he added to it, and Margot Robbie is the same way, playing Harley Quinn, they add a certain bit of charisma and energy that Batman versus Superman didn't have. They add the personality that movie didn't have.
Yeah. And I agree. I thoroughly enjoyed Margot Robbie's portrayal of Harley Quinn. She did a fantastic job. To me, it was, it was right down even to, you know, sometimes you had that Mr. J, you know, some of that stuff was just so right on. It was what you pictured in Harley Quinn. They had an interesting scene in there where her and Joker are kind of dancing around and she's in her traditional clown costume, which I thought was, it was entertaining.
That was the most chaste costume she had.
Yeah. we'll get to that in a minute. But Jared Leto's portrayal of the Joker, we don't see him a ton, but from what we did see him and what we got from him, I enjoyed. I thought he did a great job. It reminded me of the Mark Hamill Joker from the Batman animated series.
He's a little bit of a mix of all those things. He does come off at points kind of like Heath Ledger light, which I think everyone kind of expected. It's hard to get away from that. But what I think Leto and the production are trying to do is give you a more modern Joker a little bit, but with an edge to
tones
it, which is kind
of
what Ledger did. But you're right in the fact that he incorporates a lot of the other Joker personalities. I'd say he's very far away from Jack Nicholson and Cesar Romero by far, but that was a different take on the Joker.
Yes.
This Joker isn't that crazy complete loner that Heath Ledger's was.
Correct.
He's definitely more the kind of Mark Hamill madman. But I'd say that even that some of the things I didn't like about it had nothing to do with Leto's portrayal, which I thought was totally fine.
Yeah.
You're right, he's not in the movie very much. He's definitely presented as almost more, though, of a deranged pimp, which we can get into, which I didn't really – I don't really care for that take on the Joker. It's perhaps why I think Ledger's was so successful is Ledger took out any real – motive, normal human motivations you'd have for what the Joker does.
Yeah.
Meaning that we sit there and we try to relate to him and we absolutely cannot. And trying to make the Joker relatable is a mistake.
Yeah.
But they've done it in the other incarnations. They've tried to do it here a little bit to make give us some somewhat of a relatability. Oh, he's on a quest to do this or that. The Ledger's Joker, his motivations are so alien to your normal person that they set him up and above the story, which is why he, I think, he was able to shine so brightly. He just never felt like somebody we could ever pinpoint because we didn't know what was going on in his mind.
Yeah. No, and I agree. I think Ledger has by far done the best, but I thought for what they were trying to do in this movie and the way they were trying to set it up.
He belongs in this universe, which I think is a certain credit. They make him belong without destroying the essentials of who the character is.
Yeah.
Which, again, unlike some of the stuff I saw in Batman.
Exactly.
Look at Lex Luthor, them trying to do a new, more modern Lex Luthor in Batman versus Superman, and in my case, failing miserably with it. That's not this.
Yeah, and I agree. To me, there was nothing sophisticatedly brilliant about Lex Luthor. You got me on this train, Nathan.
Sorry.
I'm going to ride it. There was nothing sophisticatedly brilliant about Lex Luthor. I think you can portray a tortured Lex Luthor, but still portray the brilliance in the smooth, suave calculation. Smallville did that. Smallville portrayed a Lex Luthor who was abused by his father, not physically from what we could tell, but certainly emotionally, certainly verbally, never being good enough and him knowing exactly. But in that he was also this brilliant calculating person who was constantly trying to work through things and constantly trying to plan and scheme and get ahead. And just does that very calm and collectedly a lot of times, not always. He does lose his cool. He does come off psychotic sometimes, but not the way that we saw in Batman versus Superman.
So they do retain if we do that analog with the Joker in Suicide Squad, they do retain that sense of the Joker being a wild card.
Yes.
But a lot of the two, we'll get to that. Some of my issues with him are also tied to the fact that he is really more of a plot device in Suicide Squad. He's not really a character. There's let's go ahead and keep going and we'll get back to the Joker.
Yeah. To me, the characters, they brought them together. I thought it worked to a degree. I will say this is not typically what you see and expect from the Suicide Squad.
As a comic book, in the
Suicide Squad in the comic books, what you see and expect is a bunch of hardened criminals who are they are interested in themselves. They are looking to see what they can get out of it. In cases of most of them, they are looking to get time off their sentence. They're looking to get whatever they can to exploit to their advantage. They would be willing to turn on you in a heartbeat. And so, when they're threatened or when they're, kind of pressed under the thumb of the government, it doesn't bother you as much. These Suicide Squad members, they tend to have a conscience. They're not the sociopaths that
are sociopaths. They're just sociopaths with a little bit of conscience.
Right. But it's so much so that, they care for people outside of themselves. They have love interests, whether it's romantic or familial, whatever it might be. They do have things that are tying them and bringing about a sense of right and wrong.
I think that's a fair point, and it's something that could be viewed to some people probably as a strength and to some people as a weakness. I do think – I will say – that. Let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Do you think that in David Ayer's original vision for this, maybe whether it's at the script level or with the assembly of the film, do you think it was his intention to have that hardened group of criminals like you mentioned who – Essentially, because this feels like Dirty Dozen Light. Now, the Dirty Dozen, they go in, and what they establish is that honor among thieves,
right,
which is a very generic term, but it's even used in the film, that they become comrades to themselves. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're really looking to do good. It's
right.
just that among themselves, they have established a sense of camaraderie, that they'll be true to each other. That they'll be true to these other guys in the group because they're all kind of under the same thing. That doesn't really make them good guys by any stretch of the imagination.
Right.
But they're going to see this through. They're going to do this. Part of that, too, I think, is that it's putting them in a situation where they get to use their expertise.
Sure.
Whether that's to the same wicked ends they were using them previously or not, they get to kind of just full-on be these crazy individuals that they are. That was a Dirty Dozen. I think that was a Suicide Squad, probably in comic form, that, yeah, you are Deadshot or somebody like that. But in a certain sense, the essence of who some of these characters are is that they just delight in being themselves. So whether you're killing bad guys or you're just killing, you know, random people.
Right.
How much is the difference? Like Harley Quinn doesn't seem to care whether she's beating somebody to death with a baseball bat, whether it's one of the people, one of the Joker's targets, or these mutants, we'll get to in a minute, who are sort of storming them. But I wonder that they haven't, I mean, I think one of the potential weaknesses, I think what makes DC look a little desperate here is that they seem to really be trying to wedge this in to the same mold. I think that Marvel didn't look so much that way with Deadpool because essentially Deadpool still is kind of a hero. Like, I think in the comics, Deadpool was still essentially a kind of hero.
Right.
Just about as much a hero as the Punisher is. He was just a really sarcastic douchebag hero. And so everything in that movie that made it rated R was a lot more about the characters just disenfranchised attitude. I mean, there was a lot of violence. He does kill people. We're not saying he doesn't, but I'm talking at the, if you strip all that stuff away in Deadpool, one of my complaints with Deadpool is it still felt like the average Marvel movie. The guy's trying to get the girl. Mm-hmm. He's going to fight the bad guy. It's kind of a mission of vengeance at some level. There wasn't, the movie wasn't really different in a way. It wasn't really subversive as people were saying it was. And the same thing is true of Suicide Squad. Suicide Squad is rated PG-13.
Yep.
We can get to that in a minute. I don't know if it really needed to be or should have been. It feels like it's caught in a limbo there. But I guess I'm saying, I wonder that when it began creation, if Ayer's intention was not to have these characters be grittier, be a little more flawed. What the movie's trying to make you buy is that these are a series of broken people who, under the right circumstances, would choose to do the right thing.
Right, do the right
but
thing.
I don't think that's really who these characters are. I think that they are still unequivocally villains. The few moments where they choose to do right things. There's one character in here, maybe close to two, but there's one in the movie who I think legitimately has reformed, who is looking for redemption. One character.
Right.
The others all have selfish agendas. They eventually go along and attempt to do the right thing,
right,
but not for any other reason than either A, it gives them a chance to be their own innately crazy selves,
right,
or it's advantageous to them.
Yeah, and I would agree with that to a certain extent, except there are too many moments that demonstrate something else. And so let me just give one small spoiler away: the relationship between Joker and Harley Quinn. Joker, if you remember in the animated series, Joker was ready and willing to cut bait with Harley Quinn at a moment's notice. Like, there was nothing in Joker that was tying him to her. His obsession was Batman. If Harley Quinn was going to kill Batman, Joker would have killed Harley Quinn first before he let her kill Batman. There was nothing intrinsically holding him to her. This movie portrays a genuine affection. No matter how twisted it is or how perverse, there is a genuine affection that he has for her. He's willing to do certain things for her. And I don't know if you remember that from that kind of difference and split from what you saw in the animated series. And the reason why I'm bringing up the animated series is because that was Harley Quinn's first inception. That was when she came about, that character. So that is the most anthology that we have on her as a character. This is very different because it's showing a side of both of these characters. Now, I think her portrayal was good because she was very tied to the Joker. She was always, you know, he was her world. She was going to do anything and everything for him. And I thought that was very good. What I thought was odd was they took a character like the Joker and they tied him to her in a sense that I don't think we'd ever seen before. Do you see that?
I do. Well, I agree. And that's something I was going to bring up later. The thing with the Joker and Harley Quinn opens up a whole kind of can of worms. It kind of really delves into some of the things I didn't like with the movie, but also didn't felt where I saw the disconnect between what maybe the director was trying to do and what the studio wanted done. Where I talked about this movie being kind of a limbo. What I'd really like to talk about that, but maybe we'll just backtrack just a little bit. Maybe we can talk about the characters, the whole team, who they are. But that's an excellent point, what you're saying about the Joker, about the fact that Harley Quinn was originally a Batman the Animated Series character. So I'll just say this one thing, and then we can come back to it. In Batman the Animated Series, you know, it had that much more kind of lighter tone. So the Joker had a very specific kind of mold that he never broke out of, which was he was crazy, he was nuts, and he was all unto himself.
Right.
But the Joker only seemingly cares about the Joker and how he can take what the Joker is, his essence, and basically infect people with
it.
And I don't think necessarily that what Ayres was going for in his portrayal of the Joker and Harley Quinn here is any different, but rather more nuanced.
Yeah.
And I don't think because of how the movie has been edited or adjusted that the nuance is captured. But we can get back to that.
Sure. Well, the only reason I brought that up was to show that I think there was something going on with this initial set of characters that we're going to talk about that delves outside of themselves.
Yeah, I think that there are things. I think it's in the movie. Mm-hmm. What my questioning was, I don't know if it was intrinsically built into the DNA, like when they were making it.
Right.
Whether I absolutely agree. You can't get away from the fact that there are scenes in here that soften the Suicide Squad and try to paint them as heroes.
Yeah.
My question is, was that a concerted effort on all fronts, or is it a studio-imposed mandate once they saw that Batman versus Superman was being knocked for being too dark?
Sure.
And that's what I think. Like, let me back up and say I totally agree with you that in this movie they are painted more as heroes, but I don't know
that was
the initial intention. If I don't think that – I see too many strains in the story to suggest that that was always the case.
Yeah, and I think you're right there. I think there was something that went on in the editing that did that. Let's go ahead and like you said, Nathan, let's introduce these characters that we have in the Suicide Squad. Let's start with the most forgettable one, or he may be the most memorable one just because he was taken out early.
Yeah, let's also back up and say this is the point. We've kind of covered our basic feelings on the story. From here on, there's going to be spoilers. So if you want to see the movie, go see the movie, come back, and then we can go from there.
Right, or if you don't care about the spoilers.
Yeah, if you don't care about spoilers, that's fine. So we are going to kind of probably talk about who lives, who dies right now.
So the first character that we have is Slipknot. You and I were doing some research ahead of time just to kind of refresh ourselves with the comic book character.
He's a character who climbs things. He can climb things really well. That's what they say in the movie. He doesn't really get to demonstrate it. He starts to climb a building and then he's dead.
Yeah.
And my issue with this character was he's played by Adam Beach, who's a Native American actor who's a very good actor. I believe he got his start in a small movie in 1998 called Smoke Signals.
Yes.
Which, if no one's ever seen, it's a great movie.
It is a great movie.
Most people may be familiar with him for playing Ira Hayes in Flags of Our Fathers, the Clint Eastwood first of his two Iwo Jima movies.
Yeah.
That idea that they cast, and I don't know enough about Slipknot to know whether his background is that he is Native American or not, but there's so much talk these days about things being whitewashed and everything, that to have this character who comes in, he's a Native American actor, Adam Beach doesn't get to be in a ton of movies usually because of this kind of thing. You know, he always has to kind of play the Native American character. So he's a member of the Suicide Squad. He joins the group. He doesn't even get an intro. I believe that Margot Robbie and Will Smith both get two intros.
Yes.
They get introduced and then they get reintroduced when Amanda Waller, Viola Davis's character, who is the kind of government suit who's bringing them all together.
Yep.
She starts naming, rattling off who they are. Slipknot, I'm sure in some version of this, he did have one, but maybe for the sake of time or for whatever, they cut him, which makes you think, well, how useful is he going to be? You don't get, he doesn't get introduced until they bring him off the boat and off the plane and introduce him there where everyone's being assembled just to go on the mission. And he's in the mission for about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And then he's killed Captain Boomerang, Jai Courtney's Captain Boomerang kind of talks him into testing out to see if the devices in their neck will work. And boom, his goes off, his head blows up.
Yeah.
And he doesn't do anything. It's a complete waste of the character. And it doesn't feel right either because you have this minority character and played by a very good minority actor. And he's actually just completely disposable. He's portrayed as being disposable. It was a real mistake. I mean, that never should have gone out with the cut of the film. He would have been better to cut his character completely than to do what they did with him. Yeah. I do understand that you and I doing some research that the way that plays out where Boomerang kind of talks him into doing something and like, oh, it'll be fine, where he wants to save his own skin, played out in the comics. I think that what we have learned about Slipknot in the comics is that he was himself a disposable puff character. I don't think he was killed, but he was constantly the guy that was walking around a corner getting disabled to demonstrate that the threat was real. He got his arm blown off because Captain Boomerang told him, oh, those bombs are fine. They're not. They're fake bombs. And then, boom, his arm goes off.
Right. Boomerang just looks at him.
Yeah, well, better you than me, which is kind of his attitude in the movie. So that didn't sit well with me. I guess we've just given that away right off that happens to him. But he's unessential to this movie in any way.
Yeah.
And it seems like in the editing, once they realize they didn't do much with him, they've cut as much of him. He has three or four lines. You get no sense of what he does. You don't even really know what his superpower is.
Right.
You see him use a few pulleys and ropes, and you're like, I don't get it. Why'd they call this guy in?
Right.
And then he's dead.
Well, and really, the way it plays in the movie is it's almost like he stole one of Batman's grappling hooks. And
he's literally like red shirt number three in a Star Trek movie.
Yeah.
I mean, that's all he is. And the movie has been so merciless in the way that they've edited it that they don't even try to trick the audience into thinking you're going to see more of it.
Right.
When he doesn't get an intro, I'm like, that's not a good sign.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I agree completely. I think it's one thing if you're going to kill a character like that, bring him in, you know, have him at least halfway through the mission and something happens and he dies. But yeah, I mean, within 2 minutes of them,
they don't even do anything. Yeah. They walk in and Boomerang's like, I'm getting out of here.
Right.
And they get him. So let's talk about Captain Boomerang.
Yeah.
Let's
Captain Boomerang, was one of the initial Suicide Squad members.
What a dumb villain.
Here's the joke, even in the DC universe, is that Flash has the dumb villains.
Yeah. They even have bad names.
Yeah. Boomerang, Captain Cold.
Reverse Flash.
And this it really is a joke, and they've made it a joke on the CW where you have Cisco who's kind of naming all these villains.
Well, I think you said, was it you that said the other day that like Gorilla Grodd is like one of their most serious villains?
Yeah.
He's a giant telepathic gorilla.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, that's for the most part, that's the way the Flash is. It's just something that's been accepted.
Well, Boomerang almost seems to be here just so we can have a small Flash cameo from Ezra Miller, which, honestly, people, it isn't much. You see him, he actually looks like the Flash this time instead of some kind of berserk hobo.
Right.
But he doesn't really get to do much. He comes in, he says a few lines. It's nothing. You can't really compare him to Grant Gustin. There's not enough there to go on.
Right.
You're basically like, hey, there's the Flash, and then he's gone again. It was okay. I mean,
you actually
kick off of the Justice League.
You get more footage from him in the Justice League trailer that came out at Comic-Con than you do in this movie.
Yeah, it's very, very brief. So I think Boomerang's there, but I will say this: Boomerang is the Australian kind of jewel thief, and he's got a boomerang, and that's basically it. He's definitely the kind of gruffer. He's probably the most Dirty Dozen-ish of the group, and then he's there mostly for like comic relief. He's kind of a joke. He's definitely kind of everyman. He's the most everyman for himself. At least it seems to be the case. He's just going to do whatever is in the best interest of himself, and they're pretty true to that throughout the movie. There's a point when the Joel Kinnaman character, what is his name? The colonel who's
Colonel Rick Flagg.
Yeah, Rick Flagg, who has brought them all together. It's basically does finally give them the ultimatum that you can go or you can come with me and help do this. They've been under the gun the whole time, forced to do this, and at some point they get to choose to do this. We knew that was coming in a movie like this. And he picks the beers up and runs.
Yeah.
He eventually just rejoins everyone else. Once everybody else has decided to do it, he's like, screw it, I'll do it too. But, I mean, they essentially, I will say this, there's not much to his character. He's kind of goofy looking with some weird, he looks like he jumped out of Mad Max a little bit.
Yeah.
Jai Courtney is a character who, to me, an actor who, to me, sorry to say, is totally bland.
Sure.
He was in whatever the last Die Hard movie was, the fifth one.
Live Free or Die Hard?
No, A Good Day to Die Hard, maybe. Okay. He played Willis's son, I think, in that movie. He was in Terminator Genesis. He seems to be this guy who keeps showing up in like franchise movies, and they keep trying to give him character and personality. He just doesn't seem to have any.
Sure.
I think he had the most character and personality I've seen in this movie. He was totally fine. Like when I saw him on the list, I was like, oh man, this guy. But he did okay. I mean, he tried to give the character some personality. Maybe he does better under a fake accent and lots of weird hair accoutrements. I don't know.
Could be, but I. It's interesting that you started out with him because I think if you're not, this is what we're going to do now. I think he was the least acknowledged out of the Suicide Squad. He had, to me, the least to do with anything. In terms of his backstory, again, wasn't a whole lot.
That's kind of what I've been going through. Was like from most expendable to least expendable. And it's really just in my mind, like thinking through – straining to remember who's on the team.
Right.
The next, I think, in that regard would probably be Killer Croc.
I agree. Yeah.
Who, let me say, so the actor who plays Killer Croc, who has a name who's always difficult for me to pronounce, but Dale Akinboye or something like that. I mean, he's an African. I should have it in front of me trying to pronounce. I don't.
Just I'm say sorry. It with confidence.
Mr. Echo from Lost.
Yes.
Or he was in Oz. He was great in Oz.
He was
his character in Oz.
He was. Oh, I can't remember.
Terrific
now.
Actor.
Yeah. He was in, he was also in G.I. Joe.
Yeah, yeah. He's been in a ton of movies. I mean, he's in a lot of stuff. Unfortunately, he does tend to sometimes get cast in movies where he plays characters that are lost under a lot of makeup.
Yeah.
He was in, you probably don't even know he was in it, but he was in Thor: The Dark World.
Yeah.
And in Thor: The Dark World,
he was the cursed.
Yeah, I think he was in the first Bourne movie too.
Yeah.
Not under makeup, but he was Bourne's first target.
Yes.
The very beginning of the movie. Fantastic actor, has a great presence about him. Again, in this movie, he's trapped under so much makeup that I'm not sure much of him comes through at all. Which is kind of a shame because I'll say, and this is where I wonder about these cuts and everything made. Killer Croc to me was always an interesting Batman villain.
Yeah.
Because he was a character that I don't think was intentionally supposed to be a villain.
Correct.
He could have gone either way. They kind of do a little bit of this when they do the movie Batman Returns and they make the Penguin this sort of mutant freak that gets flushed down the sewers.
Right.
That's not really who the Batman comic version of the Penguin is.
No.
The Batman comic version is more of a gangster / entrepreneur. He's not this mutated, misunderstood thing that could have gone either way, but it's been sort of pushed into violence by a life of violence, which is kind of what the Killer Croc really is.
Yep.
He lives down in the sewers. He's been a mutant his whole life in terms of the way he's treated and behaved, the way society has treated him has pushed him to a place where he is constantly responding in violence. Most of what he does, he's also in that case very easily to be used by other villains for their own ends. Often Killer Croc is the heavy who is often manipulated by others. If he has a component in the Marvel universe, I'm thinking a character like the Abomination.
Yeah.
Emil Blonsky's the Abomination, a character that is so on the fringe of humanity that sometimes his choices, or even Grodd in some ways, his choices and what he does aren't so much based off of real true villainy, but based off of a sense of alienation from society.
Yeah.
So they capture that, but I think with an actor of his caliber, we could have had a lot more and needed to have a lot more of Killer Croc being the kind of guy who is there and could really go either way because he's never really had the opportunity to show himself for any more than being a monster.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. Next is it Katana?
Katana, oh my goodness, she seemed to be extreme. So Katana, from what I can understand in the movie, she's not even the villain. She's not one of the villains.
No.
She's brought in as like backup for Flag.
Yeah.
And they have this whole storyline where she has a possessed sword that has her husband's soul in it.
Yes.
And he mentions that, but no one really talks about how that's kind of weird.
Yeah.
And, you know, don't get stabbed or your soul's going into her sword.
Right.
Well, that's weird. She seems to be the most in terms of like in terms of someone who must have had more on-screen time.
Yeah.
She is almost relegated to background.
Yeah.
And it's a shame because there are a lot of female characters in this. I will say this, that there's at least three main members of the team. One of them does go on to kind of become the big villain.
Right.
That are female characters. And actually, if you add in Viola Davis as Amanda Waller, you have four.
Four.
And in this storyline, though, Katana is really pushed to the wayside.
Yeah.
I mean, she does some cool things. She does some cool fights. But you get no sense of her as a character at all.
Yeah, I agree. And I agree, too. I think that was one of the more disappointing things that happened was they bring the character in. They introduce her. You don't even get that bit about her backstory until the final fight scene at the end of the movie.
Yeah, he mentions a few things about the sword, and then at the end you get that, but you never see like some phantom of the husband and the sword. There's nothing really there. There's a few flashes here or there.
Yeah.
So I guess then the next character as we're going up the hierarchy, I guess it would really be Diablo.
Diablo,
who I mentioned earlier, there's the one character who truly seems to be seeking redemption, and that's the case here.
Yeah.
It's played by an actor, Jay Hernandez, who you've probably seen in movies, but he's hard to recognize here. He's bald, he has a lot of tattoos and everything, and he is this sort of like gangbanger character who, through the process of being this kind of gang lord, also developed or found that he was able to harness his ability to basically fling fire.
Yeah.
And when he gets really emotional, he
loses control.
Things, right. And so in this story, he has a tragic backstory involving his family, and he has made this vow that he will never commit violence again against people. He will not commit violence. So having this character come along and being a character who in his own heart is reformed, but trying to help and be of assistance while not breaking his oath, we see that a lot. But it's handled well. I think he plays the character well. There are some weird questions I have about his character because it seems towards the end we move away from him being almost this sort of metahuman with the ability to shoot fire, and then he's almost like Ghost Rider a little bit. Like towards the end, he actually manifests, seems to be like a demon that comes out and sort of takes over. And when we were looking at his backstory, he seems to be like DC's answer to Ghost Rider.
Exactly.
Like that this character of Diablo and the character Santana, the version that we see in this movie, is really the like second incarnation. The first one was Lazarus Lane, I think you told me. It was the first incarnation. He's more of an Old West Jonah Hex sort of villain.
Yep.
And a character who, and I think he interacted with Swamp Thing, you told me, that he has this demon of vengeance.
Yeah.
So it was weird because when I saw this, and again, this is weird 90s special effects kind of
show,
I thought this is kind of like Ghost Rider.
Yeah.
And that was before I knew any of that backstory. But I think he does well. He adds some heart to the story, I think, in the sense that you do have a character who is legitimately trying to atone, but trying to reconcile his own capacity for violence with being able to do anything meaningful in this movie.
Yeah, I agree. I think the next two for me are – well, actually, let's stick within the team. So I think you have Flag and you have Waller at this point.
Waller, and then you have the two marquee names that are at the top. We've already mentioned that being Deadshot and
Harley Quinn.
And then the Enchantress.
Who is separate as
– she basically defects from the team very early on and becomes the bad guy.
Yeah, so. But she does that – I feel like she does that earlier enough in the movie
she's
not even
– she's on the other side of the fence for almost the entire film.
Yeah.
She is the catalyst for why Flag is involved.
Yes.
Because she's taken over his girlfriend and whatnot. But
so to me, I mean, you know, the portrayal of Flag and Waller, I thought – those were both good. I will say, you know, one of the differences with Waller is Waller, in theory, is in support of metahumans and the Justice League and what they can do. Her concern in the movie is what happens if you get a Superman who's on the wrong side of the law and wants to establish this team. In the comics, I couldn't find it specifically, but I seem to remember more that it was the answer to the Justice League.
Yeah.
They were the counterpart to the Justice League. What do we do if the Justice League goes rogue? there became a huge tension between the government and the Justice League because of this. And so what we see is, again, a softer side of Waller and Flag that we didn't necessarily have in the comics.
And in this iteration, we have that scene at the very end, which is like the credit scene or whatever, where Batman, where Bruce Wayne comes in and talks to her. So you actually have it happening the opposite in this, where the Suicide Squad pops up first as a result of the death of Superman.
Yes.
And then you have Wayne coming in and just furthering this view, I think, of Batman as a character that is willing to do corrupt and wrong things to achieve ends, where he basically agrees to help Davis by Waller by pushing all this under the rug, helping to kind of protect them. And he tells her to disband the team. But I don't see any kind of version of Batman that would have ever assisted something like the Suicide Squad with all these villains, putting them on the street, that this is not something that the Batman from the comics or any iteration of Batman except for this one would have ever been a part of. So again, it seems something where they're like, I'm all for seeing a Ben Affleck Batman, but I just have no – what they've done, what DC seems to be continually doing with this character is painting him as a guy who will do whatever it is.
Yeah.
And you're welcome to do that version, but I have no interest in him really. Yeah. So that seemed to only further my problems I have with the Batman character. He has one other scene in this movie with Deadshot in the beginning. Yes. And even there where he plays Deadshot against his daughter, didn't feel very Batman-y. He says a statement about, you know, well, I don't want your daughter to be part of this. But even there, he follows surveillance information that Waller has given him. He doesn't hunt him down with his detective abilities. He's just basically being a stooge for the government. So every scene that Batman has in this movie really is not that interesting. There's one scene where he's chasing Harley Quinn and the Joker that I thought, hey, I would like to see that Batman movie. There was a moment there where it did capture that interplay back and forth that you were familiar with from Batman, the animated series, where it felt like, okay, I could get behind this. Maybe
Hopefully
Affleck
that's
can
the
still
Batman
pull
will,
something
yeah.
out in that. So I did enjoy those few minutes, but everything else with him didn't buy in. Yeah. So it seems like Justice League is going to – he tells them, shut him down. I've got something I'm doing. So he's going to bring in the Justice League. Suicide Squad has actually popped up prior to the Justice League.
Yes. Suicide Squad is the catalyst to what we will see in the trailer with the Justice League, actually.
And I thought Flag was fine. I like the Enchantress as a villain. I thought that the idea of this sort of evil ancient witch, and I like they always give their stats, and they're like age 43, and hers is like age 6,496 or something like that. That was kind of cool. The actress, the French actress Carla, and again, don't have the name in front of me. But she's going to be in Luc Besson's Valerian and the City of 1,000 Planets, which looks really cool. She has a lot of energy, I thought, that she brought to playing both the Enchantress and the Jane, the girl that she has taken over.
Yes.
So that was all pretty cool. I thought some special effects on her don't really work. They're kind of cheesy.
Yeah.
But her reanimating her brother and they're trying to be gods, that was neat. It just turns into another gotta stop the crazy doodad from
swirling
doing
swirling vortex
do.
In the sky.
I think Will Smith's character actually says something, Deadshot says something in the line of, well, I guess we're gonna stop that swirling ring of trash in the sky. So a swirling ring of trash is probably kind of what this movie feels like at times, but it is a fun swirling ring of trash. So I know we're kind of coming down. So let's talk then, I guess, about the last two.
Yeah. Deadshot and Harley Quinn.
Yeah, so Enchantress is over here as the villain. She's also sort of, you don't get a lot of that back and forth between the two sides of her personality. It's basically Enchantress for most of the movie. You don't see much of the girl except in flashbacks with Kinnaman's Flag, who Kinnaman did a fine job, but nothing outstanding. I mean, he's fine. So Deadshot, definitely feel like they did kid gloves with his character.
Yeah.
They definitely play him up as the guy who probably has the most arc, in a sense. He wants to be a good father. He doesn't necessarily care about killing people, but he wants his daughter to respect him.
Right.
The only part that he cares about killing people is how it affects how the way she sees him.
Yes.
And, I mean, we've seen that before. That's a pretty common and tired thing. But Smith brings a lot of energy to it, more than he has in recent years to things. And I thought he probably saved a lot of the movie.
Yeah.
By being that. I also should mention the villains they fight, for the most part, are these mutant slaves that seem to have been created by Enchantress when she gets a hold of these people that are in the city. So it's just a wave of zombies, really. It's a way to kill things without and retain your PG-13 rating.
Right.
So Deadshot is a guy who seems to have somewhat of a code.
yeah.
a little bit, that he won't shoot Harley Quinn off of the chopper because what has she done to him?
Right.
Nothing really. But he's killed plenty of people that haven't done anything to him, and they've right. offered him money. So
right.
that's a little inconsistent. But there's this part of his conscience that seems to be kicking in.
Yeah.
And he finally decides to go with Kinnaman. He has a great speech where he says, I'll get you there. You don't have to carry you. It'll be like a book out of the Bible.
Right.
And he's kind of the turning point for the rest of the team to kind of follow along. Yeah. He's never really a good guy, but he's a guy who sees value in doing this particular thing at this particular time.
Right.
Which to me is probably more what the Suicide Squad of the comics was. A guy
yes.
who feels like I can do this particular thing yeah. at this particular time. Being played by Smith is what softens him. If
yeah.
if the actor who plays Killer Croc had played
sure.
him, you would have seen a different, more nuanced version of Deadshot,
yeah.
I think. You know, if any, some a different actor at all had played him. I mean, there could have been anybody, but Smith has a certain sort of geniality to him mm-hmm. that, as we mentioned, was missing from Independence Day. Like,
yes.
you take out that charm, you lose something. He's
yes.
not – some movies have failed by not – tapping into that, like After Earth, but
yep.
like in this, I think they tapped into enough that it worked. And then
I agree.
Margot Robbie, she was fun as Harley Quinn. She did. I think that's my Tank Girl comparison. She reminded me.
Yes.
I always thought back in the day, if they had done a Harley Quinn back in the 90s when she first showed up, Lori Petty would have been a perfect
Harley Quinn. Yeah.
And so Robbie, who's not like Petty in any way at all, and it doesn't really tapped into that craziness before. We last saw her actually in Tarzan playing
yep.
Jane in a very kind of straight laced sort of thing. And she's fine here. She's good.
Yeah.
The costuming is ridiculous. I mean, she like that part of her. I know is part of the character, but again, in the cartoons, we mostly saw her in her Harlequin and her little like jester
yep.
costume. And we see that for a second here. She's a lot more like she is the Joker's mole in this, but she's almost like his prostitute
yeah.
in some ways. Like the way she's portrayed. There's a scene with Common that's really kind of seedy
yeah.
where she's kind of doing a strip sort of thing. She's seen as his property.
Yeah.
Which I think is where we get into that. My problem with the character dynamics is it's very, very twisted. It's a super twisted relationship that's seen here. I don't think the Joker goes after her because he has any true care for Harley Quinn as a person. Because we see him create her in a sense. We see her
right.
as Harley Quinzel, the psychiatrist who's
right.
working with the Joker and gets pulled into him. And then he's like, oh, this is going to hurt a lot. And she's agreeing to it. And it's
right.
like, you know, I don't know at this point what's going on, but this is weird, twisted, like 50 Shades of Batman kind of deal between the two of them. And which didn't sit well with me for this kind of PG-13 view.
Sure.
And they don't delve into her character enough to make that care, to make her shown as this woman who's essentially been abused to the point that she's lost her mind. Or she lost her mind first and then agreed to the
right.
abuse, and it's just snowballed. The Joker goes after her because she's his property, as far as I can tell. Just the way he would go after anything else that somebody took from him. There are a few scenes
yeah.
that you mentioned where there's a really creepy scene where he has her jump into a vat.
Right.
But again, it's all about the control of the Joker. The relationship seems to be one-sided on Harley Quinn's side. So I think the nuance of what they're seeing there, we're trying to see why she would love him, but I don't think he does anything in the context of the movie that shows that the Joker reciprocates that love.
I don't think I think you're right to a certain extent. The thing that brought it to my mind was that scene that you were talking about. You have a moment where he's walking away and he pauses.
Yeah, and he goes back in to get
right.
her.
There's a struggle that's going on there.
But it's hard to tell there if it's the same. Like with the Joker, there's that erratic thing. You know,
right.
he mentions in The Dark Knight, he's like a dog chasing cars.
Right.
He wouldn't know what to do if he caught one. Where he does something, and this is true of any iteration of the Joker, but then he second guesses because he's crazy.
Right.
So I saw that, honestly, as a kid who throws his toy into the fire because he can.
Mm-hmm.
But then he's like, damn, I really like that toy.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes back in to get the toy, not because he has any care of whether the toy actually burns up, except that if it burns up, he won't have it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my I think that they would have been in a bigger trouble had they shown the Joker reciprocating feeling, because it would have created a very twisted view of things that I don't think they were not willing to walk down that path. I'm not saying they shouldn't have, but this movie doesn't delve into those sorts mm-hmm. of things. And this is why I say there's probably a longer cut somewhere. There is a scene in this movie where towards about the middle, Harley Quinn has every reason to believe that the Joker is dead.
Yeah.
That he's come for her, but he failed.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't leave her behind, but he failed.
Right.
And now her world's just kind of broken up.
Right.
And then the Suicide Squad comes back upon her, and she's there, and she has the ability to re-team them. And this is the first moment where you have this, which I thought was what all this was building to, that Harley Quinn is now potentially, this is the first time since she's been broken in her mind,
yeah,
that she has the ability to be her own person, to be, to do whatever it is she wants right. to do, with the freed up idea that the Joker's gone, that there won't be a Joker again, that yeah. she can't have that. There's a scene later where Enchantress gives them views of what they want. We see right. that, according to this movie, Harley Quinn wants a normal domestic right. life, but the Joker is that twisted thing
yeah.
that represents somewhere she thinks she sees the person and the thing that she wants, but it doesn't really exist,
yeah.
which is why I think any reading of where the Joker is really like has true feelings for her doesn't seem to really be backed up by the movie.
Yeah.
I think that they do show that he likes her as a piece of property, but not necessarily as a person.
Right. And I would agree with that. I would say the difference is the iteration we're used to of the Joker up until this point doesn't show that at all in his relationship with her.
Yeah, yeah. Well, because I think when she shows up in the comic, she's just a henchman, and then yeah. everyone makes a mistake of thinking the Joker cares about things.
Right.
I will say that, yes, that's why I say he's more portrayed as a pimp.
Yeah,
I don't think a pimp has much care for their prostitute charges.
Right.
They just care about what they can do for them and the fact that they're their property.
Right.
So that's why I say the baseline seems to be the Joker is kind of a deranged pimp, mm-hmm. which isn't as interesting as the crazy,
sure,
art criminal that we've seen in the past.
Right.
So, I mean, that's kind of how the characters play out. I think DC does a fine job of making a fun action movie.
Yeah.
But I don't think that this movie is really the big... It may be a financial hit, but I don't think it's going to be the rebound, particularly with the reviews we're seeing, the rebound to getting people to think of DC in the same vein
light as Marvel.
Marvel. Because
yeah.
it's not really... I don't think it's really a success. It just I enjoyed it. It's fun. People are getting a couple hours of entertainment, but it was not the jump back from Batman versus Superman that A, they needed, and B, I don't think it's going to set up much of a need or a desire for more Suicide Squad movies.
Mm.
And it doesn't really advance much in the way, I think, of the story that people are going to see when we get to Justice League or Wonder Woman.
Mm.
I think it feels like a one-off, really, which is maybe more of what the 90s thing. Like, they may make some more, but to me, it's a bit of
right.
a one-and-done kind of thing. I don't know
yeah.
that it's not together enough. It's not unified enough as a movie. In a sense, it's kind of like the squad themselves. They're squabbling back and
right.
forth. They aren't really united. By the time they do get united, we're into the normal end of the world. Got to
right.
stop the doohickey from doing something.
Right.
Shtick, which was the less interesting part of the movie.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I would say that I'd be more interested in another Suicide Squad movie. I thought there was enough going on with the characters. I'd like to see that.
I think they could. I just wonder if there's enough in this movie to truly make the desire to have one there.
Yeah.
Like, I would watch it. I mean,
right.
And there are things you could do, and you could bring in new characters
right.
now. Let them hang around for most of the movie, at least.
Right.
But it just, what I guess I'm saying is DC needed something a little bit more substantial, a little bit more unique.
Yeah.
I don't think that this was it. But, you know, sure. I'll be honest, I was kind of starting to tell people, I was looking at the reviews, like, guys, this might not be very
right.
good. And then I kind of texted everyone and said, you know what? Go check it out. It's
yeah.
fun. Like, you'll probably like it.
And I think that's how a good way to end. You know, you and I both agreed, hey, this is a movie that we could recommend. Hey, go see it in theaters. There's nothing in the movie itself that I believe would have made the IMAX anything spectacular.
No, some of the visual effects aren't very good. The action scenes have been shot, a lot of them, in the dark and the rain, or in the dark and the rain.
Yeah.
And then at the end, in the dark and the rain, and like the smog.
Right.
So... Again, think it's budgetary things. There's no action scene you're going to watch in this movie and be like, that was fantastic.
Yeah.
It's not really what it's about. Though maybe it should have been a little bit
sure.
more, because I feel like we see so many big scenes of destruction that are just yawn-worthy. I mean,
yeah.
that's what happens in action movies these days. We see something and it's not remotely spectacular.
Right.
So this one's more about the general tone and
yeah.
the characters, I think.
Yeah. So, you know, go check it out. It's a fun movie. You know, if you're feeling like, hey, you know, even $12 might be a little out there for you, you know, go check it out in the matinee.
The matinee. Again, I'd say it's a matinee largely because it has that matinee feel to,
yeah.
like,
yeah,
to it. It's kind of a silly, disposable summer movie.
Sure. All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and sign
yeah.
off.
Reminder, too, that please, if you like what we're doing here, go on iTunes, leave us a review.
Yes.
And be honest. I mean, we just want reviews.
Yeah.
And just give your feedback, what you think. You can also email us at popcultninja.
Yeah.
popcultninja@gmail.com.
Yeah.
Leave us some feedback. Again, if you, as for everyone who's leaving iTunes reviews, we will be at the towards mid-September, I think, doing a new contest, a couple new contests.
Yep.
And what we're going to do is pull from the iTunes reviews.
Yeah.
So right now, if you're leaving, you start leaving reviews now, and by the time we get September, we're going to take all of the reviews that have been left from August forward, and put them into a pool. So you start leaving reviews and stuff now. Again, we want honest feedback, but they will be there, and they'll be something that we will start pulling for prizes when we get back to this in September.
Yep. All right. Very good. So we're going to go ahead and sign it off. We'll catch y'all later.
Take care.
Really shook the pillars of heaven, didn't we, Wayne?